Now let's kick off the session. In July, EPA held its annual National Association of Remedial Project Managers meeting in Portland, Oregon, and one of the most attended sessions was on green remediation. Because of its success, members of EPA's technical support project, led by the Engineering Forum, have taken this full-day session and are bringing back a number of the same talks as online seminars this winter. This is the second of the three sessions. EPA's definition of green remediation includes the practice of considering the environmental effects of a remediation strategy early in the process and incorporating options to maximize the net environmental benefit of the cleanup action. Some practices are quite mature, such as construction site best management practices, including stormwater runoff management and construction and demolition debris recycling. Others are still emerging, including the use of renewable energy sources, such as wind and solar, to power remedial systems. Over the three sessions, the online training will introduce you to the key technical policy and application aspects of green remediation. Before I turn it over to our first of the three speakers, I remind phone participants to put your phones on mute. If you don't have a mute button on your phone, hit star 6 now. And again, please do not put us on hold. Today's first speaker is Carlos Pashan from EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. Mr. Pashan's overall focus is on identifying and advancing best practices and new technologies in cleaning up contaminated sites. He generates and manages much of the available knowledge and information on the use of technologies in Superfund and provides site-specific support through the Brownfields and Land Revitalization Technology Support Center. Mr. Pashan is currently engaged in helping define OSWR's green remediation strategy, which is a topic of his presentation. In recent years, he also served as Deputy Director for Environmental Reviews with the United States Trade Representative and worked as a Special Assistant to EPA Administrator Johnson. Previously, his EPA duties included the development and delivery of key training Superfund courses such as remedial design and remedial action. He has held other positions outside the agency, notably as a forecast hydrologist with the NRSC Snow Survey Program. He has a BS from Colorado State University in Watershed Management and graduate degrees in Environmental and Business Management from Duke University and Georgetown, respectively. Welcome, Carlos.
Thank you, Raji. Thank you so much for the introduction. I have to make sure to get your shorter bio. And good morning, good afternoon, I should say, everybody. Thank you for joining us today. As Raji indicated, the material that is being delivered here is to a certain degree, a replay of the material that was shared with the 80 remedial project managers that attended the course in Portland earlier this summer. However, I have taken some liberty at editing my presentation. Looking at the registration page, I recognize some names that folks that I've spoken to in other venues. So I suspect that quite a few of you have heard some of the material I've delivered in the past on this overview of green remediation. So I've taken some liberty to modify a little bit, cut it down, and expand certain areas. So with that, if you'd please go to slide number 2. This is this working term of what is green remediation. A couple of points to make here. Green remediation and green cleanups is used interchangeably. Remediation is a very specific term. However, we envision green cleanups, green remediation as being something of value or of applicability across regulatory frameworks. But this working definition, if I can read the slide, the practice of considering all environmental effects of a cleanup during each phase of the process and incorporating strategies to maximize the net environmental benefit of the cleanup. So a couple of points to make here. Of course, we're cleaning up a site. That in itself is a positive environmental outcome. what we're looking at doing here is all the activities associated with being protective of human health and the environment can have an environmental impact. And the concept here is for all those activities, regardless of the remedy that we're going to put in place that need to take place, what can we do to minimize them? The italicized text I have on the bottom, the focus that reads focuses on remedy implementation versus remedy selection, is there's an important caveat in a shifting dynamic discussion. The term is, the key word here is focus. And why are we focusing on remedy implementation? The main reason is that we see right now, where we are right now, there are many opportunities to reduce the environmental footprint of any remedy, any cleanup approach we select to deal with a contaminated site. An example I like to use is some misperception there is at times is that, well, is M&A better because it uses no energy, it has a smaller footprint? Well, no, not necessarily. Or even more clearly, is the phytoremediation project a green project? We are using trees. Well, that's a good example of a good opportunity to distinguish between what might be green and not green. In the case of a phyto project, we could have a project where we're using an invasive species, if we go to the extreme, where we are over-fertilizing or we are using excessive pesticides. We're tilling the soil and we're not protecting it, so we have surface runoff that's contaminating surface water bodies with nutrient, turbidity, sediment, etc. So you could have a phyto project that's green or phyto project that is not green. So again, it's looking at remedy versus itself. Where are the opportunities to implement it in a more sustainable manner? However, at the same time, doing that is helping us, informing us as to where it is in the remedy design phase and moving upstream, I could say, into this remedy selection of where we might be able to identify those opportunities. However, we feel that we don't have the tools yet to be able to go to that extreme, but we are moving in that direction. If we could go to slide number three, this is a bit of a discussion for our federal and other government partners. The concept of is it our job? It seems pretty clear. This has been established. So this is a slide that I would probably will not use in the future because I think we're beyond this point. A couple of clear mandates. One of them is Executive Order 13423 of January 2007. And that section one, that's literally the first paragraph in the executive order. And if we can summarize it, basically mandates federal agencies to implement their missions in an environmentally, economically, and fiscally sound, integrated, continuously proven, efficient, and sustainable manner. There are also a couple of bullets pulled from EPA's strategic plan. And I take the opportunity to let you all know that EPA has put out for comment, I believe it is still out for comment, its draft strategy for 2014 that has some language in the area of green remediation. So for those of you who have an interest in that area or any other area and want to know where the agency's thinking is looking forward, I suggest you go to the EPA.gov and on the Office of the Chief Financial Officer, you can download the draft strategy and submit comments to the agency. With that, let's go to slide number four, please. This is one of the slides that I cut back on. I used to expand on those six core elements that you see in that circle, the six core elements of green cleanups. I will very briefly touch on those today. I did want an updated version of the Green Remediation webpage, which you'll get the URL to at the end of this presentation. In that webpage, each of those elements has been expanded, drawing on information that's included in the Green Remediation Primer that was released in April of this year. So now it's basically just a click away to get some more information. I did want to say a couple of things about the text on this slide and the figure. Regarding the text, one of my first comments was that OSWR, EPA, the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, sees that the concept of green cleanups, of green remediation, applies to all regulatory frameworks. This is not a Superfund-specific effort. This is not a RCRA corrective action effort. Any site, regardless of the regulatory framework under which it is being undertaken, the cleanup is being undertaken, there are potential opportunities to adopt green remediation best practices. I also mentioned earlier that it's aligned with our mandates, our strategy, and also very importantly that this overlays current existing regulatory framework. There's not a discussion here of revisiting, and this goes back to that italicized text of remedy selection versus remedy implementation. We see these opportunities to reduce the environmental footprint or cleanups as overlaying existing regulatory frameworks, regardless of what program we're cleaning up a site under. Now, if I can go back to that figure and just go around clockwise, of what are those core elements? The first is energy, and I do have a couple of slides on the topic of energy. I want to focus a little bit on that. But the idea here is how can we reduce the energy demand for a site? How can we use, is it possible, are there opportunities to use renewable energy? Are we using equipment that is as efficient as it can be? And there are also, of course, climate change implications associated with the carbon footprint associated with the energy that we use to power remedies at a contaminated site. The next element is air quality. Generally, you can picture this as air quality in the vicinity of where the site is being cleaned up. Often, one of the most common elements we like to highlight is the nature of the equipment that is being used to clean up the site. So both auxiliary equipment and what's called yellow iron, the big, large earth movers, and other equipment that you have internal combustion engines. Are we using clean diesel where possible and where available? Have we retrofitted this equipment to reduce particulate matter and maximize reductions of nitrogen oxides and SOx and other pollutants in our equipment in an effective manner? So things like idling policy, things like using the engines to keep cabs warm when we have alternative means of doing that. Overall, what can we do to reduce the impact on local air quality that the activities necessary to clean up the site might have? The next element is water. This is both water quantity and water quality, and surface water and groundwater. So, system, is there a potential for us to use the water that we have treated to recharge an aquifer versus dumping it to a POTW? I'm hearing my own echo. This is a heads up for our contract support if you can do something about it. I'm not sure if it's a problem. So, surface water quality, are we having impacts, or can we minimize impacts on streams, lakes, and other surface water bodies from sources such as turbidity and sediment running off the site, or nutrient loading from the activities that take place at the site? And then also, if we're going to revegetate the site, can we use plants that have a low water demand? The land and ecosystems, some of the examples we tend to use there is, for example, if there are sensitive species in the vicinity of the site, is there any modification we can do to the activities to minimize the impact on them, particularly if they're at a critical point in their life cycles? Other areas include soil, avoiding soil compaction. It loses its lots of its desirable properties, such as infiltration, and then we have to come back and till it, so we're getting a double benefit from minimizing soil impact on the site. And then materials and waste management. Are we recycling to the maximum extent possible? If you see any construction site nowadays, you'll see that quite often when buildings are being taken down, materials are being segregated, concrete is being used to build roads, and there are many opportunities to recycle material from the demolition that needs to take place at a site, but also minimize the amount of raw materials that are needed for all the activities that will take place to clean up the site. So I'd like to move on to slide number 4 to stay on schedule. I mentioned I'd talk a little bit more about some of the energy requirements. As far as the energy, just recap where those opportunities may be, and these are just some examples. And I mentioned energy-efficient equipment operating at peak performance, concepts like high-efficiency pumps, I recently spoke with some vendors at a conference out in the Pacific West Coast, a major corporation that rents equipment for construction projects, and asked about high efficiency pumps, and the person at the stand was not familiar with them. That told me basically that maybe there is, we can get better at communicating what our needs are, and that's certainly something that we are working with our internal project managers to raise their awareness of where the opportunities are, but to get that conversation going with all parties. Renewable energy systems to replace or offset grid electricity. On the Green Remediation webpage, we have, I believe we're up to about 20 to 25 profiles of projects where green remediation best practices have been implemented. So I invite you to take a look at those, and you'll see that there are several examples where renewable energy capacity has been installed on the site to power the remedy at several scales. We're talking from 50 kilowatts to up to megawatts. One of the issues that often comes up is that it may not make financial sense to build renewable energy generating capacity on the site only to power a remedy. However, looking back at long-term stewardship, if that is an infrastructure that we can leave on the site and convey to the future or end use of the site, it starts to make a lot more financial sense. So again, it's looking at the big picture, stepping back, and having those communications between those planning the cleanup and those planning the reuse. If we could go to slide number 6. This is a table that we generated earlier this year. Actually, it's included in the primer. And the main purpose of this is to highlight some of those technologies where that do have a relatively large energy requirement, and point out two things. One is that pump and treat is clearly the most energy-intensive treatment technology out there. Moving water takes a lot of energy. But regardless, this tells us that maybe we should focus some of our identifying best practices when it comes to pump and treat. But at the same time, note that there are opportunities throughout all of these. In the case studies that we have written up, that we have identified, there are best practices for all of these. And I'll briefly talk about a solar vapor extraction system where they almost zeroed out the need for outside power at that project. On the order of scale, that 404,000 metric tons of CO2 equivalent, that the sum of these five technologies will generate in per year from here to about 2030 on average using today's practices. It's on a global scale, it's not that important, but it is a significant figure. And based on information I have from NASA, for example, it's equivalent to about 50% of NASA's of the agency-wide carbon footprint. By the way, that table is a request I often get. If it's not up there yet, do send me an email. I can send you the spreadsheet we generated to calculate those values. That's a question that often comes up. I'm hoping to have it up on the Green Remediation webpage if it's not there already as well. So if we could go to slide number 7, a recap. So what is it that we can do about energy at sites? And this goes back to the question of should we be selecting technologies that have the lowest energy requirements? Well, no, that's not necessarily what we're saying. What we're saying is that regardless of what technology you select to clean up a site, there are probably good opportunities to reduce its energy footprint, particularly if it's on the higher energy requirement side of the scale. So what can we do? We mentioned optimizing systems to maximize efficiency. A lot of the companies on this call, I know you have worked with EPA and your end clients on optimizing systems, the whole concept of remedial system optimization. So that is really already out there, but we can take that a next step. Building renewable energy capacity at contaminated sites to power remedies. There was a conference last week in New Mexico looking at this, and across programs, cleanup programs and states, there's growing awareness as to the possibilities there are of one of the reuse potentials of contaminated sites is to place renewable energy on the sites. And we have links to that from the Green Remediation webpage. But it's not only to generate power for general use, but also to power the actual remedy that's on the site. And I have a couple of examples of that as well coming up. Tapping into grid renewable energy portfolios, that, of course, is a standing opportunity. We've saw some good examples of how that has taken place. There's often a cost differential, but then again, there is that additional benefit, and we don't know where public policy is headed on the topic of greenhouse gas. Is it going to be a cap and trade or whatever? But it's probably good to know what those options are out there to reduce our carbon footprint, and that is definitely one of them. And then finally, one thing that we have discussed in previous internet seminars, I'm not sure if there's going to be a chance to do it in this series, but it's work that's being done on carbon sequestration through the use of soil amendments from treatment systems. Again, there's a little bit of a policy vacuum there as far as how do we account for that carbon that might be sequestered. The concept here is that in certain sites, particularly abandoned mine sites out in the West, if soil amendments might be used to increase improve the soil function, to get vegetation growing again, to avoid runoff and then leaching of metals, et cetera, et cetera. And in doing that, as the soil profile matures, its carbon content increases, and that is being documented, and a protocol is being developed to document how much carbon is being sequestered. Question is, in a changing regulatory or policy framework, what does that say about carbon sinks? If we could go to slide number 8, this is one of the sites I mentioned. This is the SVE system. This is actually a RCRA corrective action site in Frankfurt, New York. And what they did at this site is they use this windmill that it moves a pump, a cylinder, I should say, a cylinder that in the updraft it creates a vacuum which is connected to the vents, which creates a vacuum which draws out the soil vapor. And in the downward motion, it closes the valve, opens another valve, and it pushes those gases that were collected out through, I believe it's activated carbon before they're released to the atmosphere. So it's been very successful in reducing VOC concentrations in soil gas, and the energy savings, I don't recall what they are right now, but this project is written up in the Green Remediation. There's a profile in the Green Remediation webpage. If you go to slide number, I believe it's 10, the Operating Industries Landfill in Monterey. A couple of things I want to say about this. This is an expanding, this is quite common now, to use methane from landfills to generate power. In this case, that power is used to operate part of the treatment system, but additionally, there's consideration of replacing these turbines, and it's something that we're looking at closely across several sites to see where the potential lies in replacing these microturbines with combined heat and power microturbines, and where we'll capture that 40%+ of BTUs that are vented to the atmosphere in a normal combustion can be recovered and used and as a part of heating elements and other energy needs of buildings on-site or off-site. So if we could go to slide 10. This is the last little project I wanted to highlight, mainly because quite often the point to mention here is that a renewable energy on a price per kilowatt may not always appear to be better than electricity off the grid. However, if we factor in the need if there's a need to wire the site, to bring the power in, to hook up to a grid, and other factors, it starts to make more sense. This project is in the Virgin Islands. Electricity costs there are significantly higher anyway, and it did make sense. There's a wind-driven turbine for the compressors and electric generators that power the pump. And the photovoltaic panels generate electricity for the fluid gathering system during an oil recovery process. Again, this is one of the projects that we've written up on the Green Remediation webpage under the profiles. And if we could go to slide 11, please. I want to briefly mention the OSWER, and I use it in quotes because there's not one office that is driving this. This is an effort across Record corrective action, Superfund, brownfields, et cetera, underground storage tanks. But basically, the efforts that we're all undertaking in green remediation, the purpose is to advance green remediation best practices across the cleanup programs. And what we're doing is benchmarking and documenting green remediation best practices. A lot of the examples that I've meant, the three examples that I've mentioned, and the profiles that we have on the Cluen webpage have come from folks that have submitted them to us. So if you have projects out there where you have put in place some of these best practices, we'd love to hear about you, from you, to write them up and include them in there. We talked about toolkit of enablers, and that's often for internal audiences, things like contracts toolkit. So how can you write a contract that encourages a consultant to propose their best thinking when it comes to adopting green remediation best practices, building networks of practitioners, such as through this call and other conversations we have with federal, state, and private parties, and then develop performance metrics and tracking mechanisms. A lot of the discussion that's taking place on remedy selection is generating a lot of knowledge on what are those metrics, what are those measures of performance, and the metrics and the units that we use to measure it, so we can better identify when and where green remediation best practices are taking place. That's definitely a really important point, and that's where I expect we'll see a lot more progress in the coming months. If we could go to slide number 12, please. This is an example of a listing of groups, and it's not comprehensive, and I know there are more out there, and some of you are probably involved and some that aren't represented. Again, if you could forward those activities, those groups to me, I'd love to hear about them. But I'm not going to go through them because I don't have time. The point to make here is that within EPA, within the federal agency, among states, and amongst private parties, private interests, there's a lot of work taking place in identifying green remediation best practices and fostering their adoption. A couple of groups to point out, maybe at the bottom, the Sustainable Remediation Forum. This is a bit of an ad hoc group of interest, both industry, regulators, states, and site owners and cleanup companies. It's a venue to share interest. They have periodic meetings. I'm sure if you Google them, you'll find them. Within EPA, a couple of groups, the CCCL, Climate Change and Contaminated Lands, is focusing on what it is that can be done through land management to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And then another example, two more groups to point out. One is the Federal Remediation Technologies Roundtable, which met here in Washington, D.C. last week, and it is establishing a green remediation subcommittee to look at green remediation across federal agencies. And then finally, state initiatives, the Cal EPA Green Remediation Team. It's one of the grandfather groups. I think they're having a conference later in January, and you can get more information. I think we linked to it from the Green Remediation webpage. So there's a lot going on out there. With that, let's go to slide number 13. I have a list of existing products and activities related to green remediation, but I wanted to go straight down to the bottom and use the final minutes I have to talk about a Green Cleanup Voluntary Standards Project. And that, let's go to 14. This is a concept that EPA has been working with a group that's formed by members from several, almost all cleanup programs, and about at least six of the EPA regions. And we've been talking about this in different venues. I hope some of you have heard about it, and looking to collaborate with states and other parties. What is the idea here? The idea is, could there be a voluntary green cleanup standard and certification program to recognize where and when folks go over and beyond the requirements of the actual protectiveness of the remedy. We have definitely identified a growing interest in social responsibility, the big concept behind green cleanups. Many companies have their own internal goals to become greener. That's a clear message that has come to it. And as I mentioned, many tools are being developed to evaluate the impacts from the cleanups. We're tracking at least 18 different tools that are being developed by private companies and federal agencies and state agencies to identify for different cleanup approaches which one is having, what impacts each one of them is having to be able to address those impacts. The states, the Association of State and Territorial Solid Waste Management Officials, they have established a green cleanup scheme as well, and one of the things that they are looking at is state and local government incentives that might be applicable to in recognition of green cleanups should a project be completed in compliance with future voluntary green cleanup standards. And then a couple of the U.S. Green Building Council has approached EPA over the past few years regarding opportunities for possibly developing a green cleanup standard that would fit into other standards such as neighborhood development, which I believe is still under development. If we could go to slide number 15. I'm going to be very brief on this, to point out that the way we understand it to be right now, voluntary green cleanup standards and certification program would have two components and two processes. The first is a standards development. We're at a very early stage of this. We have not identified who it is that we might work with, but the product, the process is basically a consensus building approach to develop what those standards are that we all believe we want to see out there. And that creates those green standards. The bottom part is, and that hasn't been decided yet, either project or a company or an individual would be recognized as green. So, for example, if it is a project, somebody could initiate a site cleanup and seek to meet the green cleanup standards. They would then have that work certified, what's called a conformity assessment, and be recognized for it. So there's two things. One is the standards, and the other is developing the standards, and the other is the process by which a project meeting those standards is certified and recognized as being a green cleanup. If we could go to slide number 16. These are some of the key attributes of what this program would be. One, it would be voluntary. We're not mandating a new cleanup evaluation. That is certainly not the intent. Transparent, particularly the consensus-based standards development, that has to be an open process with buy-in from all stakeholders involved. Universal, back to the concept of applicable to all cleanup markets, and overlaying existing regulatory frameworks. That also spills into the fourth bullet. It should be flexible, so that there can be program and state-specific recognition options depending on the regulatory framework and location and type of project that is being undertaken. Minimal resources, that's particularly important for us, given the limited resources federal government has to develop this. Independent third-party or self-certification is probably going to be an option that we'll be looking at. And then finally, market-driven. What are the drivers to adopt these best practices? It will not be, ties in a little bit to the first bullet, that it will not be mandatory. So if we go to slide 17, I've mentioned the primer. We did print a few hard copies, maybe a couple hundred, originally you can order them. You can now do that. Again, it was released in 2008, and you can download it from clune.org/greenremediation, or you can order a hard copy. And the final slide, and I think I'm a couple of minutes over, I mentioned that we revamped the Green Remediation webpage. One of the things we did is for those profiles that we have already developed, we identified the best practices that you will find in each one of them. So right here on the website itself, if you click on the name of the project, you would get the actual profile. But before you do that, here you can pick and choose, okay, am I looking for water, air emissions, what types of best practices am I looking for, and then click on the project and actually go straight to those. So I believe that is my final slide, and I thank you for your time.
Thanks, Carlos. And before I open it up for questions, I would like to remind our phone participants to put your phones on mute. And if you don't have a mute button on your phone, please hit *6. Thank you. Now, let's open it up for some questions. We have a few minutes. phone participants, go ahead. If you have any questions, please go ahead.
Yeah, Rich Freitas here from Region 9 EPA. Hello?
Hi, Rich.
Hi. Yeah, I just had a simple question. I think you might have answered it towards the end, but is there a simple checklist, kind of auditing software we could use for our sites right now, something that's simple we can just kind of run down and, you know, evaluate the carbon footprint of a site or energy usage?
No, Rich, I can send you an email. It's a table that we've been collecting, and it's very secondhand information. There are at least 18 tools out there to do that. A couple of things, and Mike Gill will probably touch on one. He's working on basically an energy calculator for different cleanup technologies. He'll be speaking today. And the other is that Region 9 has a pilot. Karen Sherman, you might want to speak with her in RCRA, where they are piloting some of those approaches. There's not really a software tool yet. It's more a process. And the Cal EPA DTSC meeting in January, I believe they're going to be touching on life cycle analyses as an approach to do that as well. So I hope that helps. You certainly have a lot of options out there, but there's not one standard prepackaged tool available.
So you'll be at the San Diego meeting next month?
No, unfortunately, I cannot be there. Deb Goldblum, who is leading, co-leading the standards development and certification program process, she will be there. She is with RCRA Collective Action in Region 3 in Philadelphia. She will be at that meeting.
So maybe we can work out something, you know, for the regions that we can use in the interim until it develops?
Yes, and again, I recommend you speak with Karen Sherman. I can send you her contact information if you need it.
I sit right across the table from me.
There are no online questions. Anybody else on the phone have any questions for Carlos? If not, thank you, Carlos.
One more question or comment?
Okay, go ahead.
This is Mika Staberson with DTSC. Just a minor correction. The symposium that we're holding is actually in February, not January. It's going to be February 4th.
I'm sorry. Thanks for that correction. Indeed, there's actually a National Brownfields Association meeting in January. I got the two confused. Sorry about that. Thanks for the correction.
Okay. If there are no other questions, again, I'd like to remind the phone, please put your phone on mute. And if you don't have a mute button, please press *6. Yep. Our second speaker is Sean Sheldrake. He has a BS in chemical engineering and has been in with EPA Region 10 since 1992. His tenure with the agency, he has been one of the project managers for one of the largest mining cleanup in the United States in northern Idaho for over 8 years. As part of this work, he oversaw the review of the effectiveness of residential cleanup, which was one of the first in the U.S. to clearly demonstrate positive impact of cleanup on children. Mr. Sheldrake has also served for over 3 years on the Lead Site Workgroup, the National EPA Project Manager Workgroup, charged with writing national guidance on how mining site cleanup and lead risk should be approached and peer review of mining site cleanup plans. The last 6 years, Mr. Sheldrake has been managing in-water early action efforts in Portland Harbor, including those at Gasco, Arkema, and Port of Portland Terminal 4. Mr. Sheldrake has also worked extensively on groundwater plume characterization, as well as in-situ and pump and treat system analysis involving chromium. Mr. Sheldrake's other duties include being a deputy dive safety officer and dive medic for EPA Region 10's dive team. In conducting diving activities at hazardous waste sites for EPA, he has helped to develop and implement polluted water sampling and survey techniques since 1997, as well as decontamination protocols. In addition to Region 10 work, he helped to organize the underwater search effort for the Columbia Shuttle for EPA in conjunction with ERT and Region 7, the Navy, and other public safety diving teams. Welcome, Sean.
Thank you, Raji. Well, today I'm going to give a recap, as Carlos mentioned, of my NARPM presentation on green remediation and transportation, which is, you know, one of the largest energy consumers, obviously, in the site cleanup phase. So moving on to slide 20. So the transportation and the vehicles that you use on your site, front-end loaders, track hose, etc., can be the biggest polluters that you have on site. And when I'm talking about polluters, of course, I'm talking about air toxics issues as well as greenhouse gas emissions. Moving on to slide 21. One of the voluntary efforts that Region 9 and Region 10 have been pushing forward on together so as not to present a competitive advantage to one port, deep water port or another, is voluntary efforts for shipboard air toxics emissions reduction across the West Coast. And that's known as the West Coast Collaborative. And I think Michael Gill will talk a little bit about that or touch on that a little bit. But basically, that is focused on reducing particulate emissions throughout the West Coast by using cleaner fuels, emissions controls, different use changes, such as the SmartWay program, reducing idle time, and coming up with different ways to heat the operator in the cab as examples of those projects. Slide 22. So why is reducing those emissions important? Well, I touched on the particulate matter issue, which is probably the worst part of the emissions for diesel vehicles. There are other chemicals in the exhaust, sulfur oxides as an example, that some of these voluntary activities have been curbing. We've also obviously got the greenhouse gas, the GHG issue, which switching from gas to diesel helps with quite a bit. Switching from a diesel truck to other forms of transportation helps to reduce GHG. The imported petroleum issue has become more and more in the forefront as prices have gone up and now gone down. But I think we all know those prices are destined to go back up again. And I'm sure it's not too far off where we'll be seeing $5 a gallon diesel and or gasoline in the not too distant future. Diesel exhaust has serious health effects. And can cause a lot of negative outcomes in people, primarily children. I'm going to go a little bit into that on slide 23. So in terms of the costs to society, those costs can be readily calculated in terms of how much you invest in diesel versus how much you can get in health benefits. It's a no-brainer calculation. You get a lot more back in health benefits for each dollar that are invested in either, you know, more costly fuels, emission controls, and other steps. You know, perhaps achieving the cleanup once the alternative has been selected, achieving it in a greener fashion. I'll talk a little bit more about that in subsequent slides. Moving on to slide 24. This slide gives, I think, everyone an idea of how small those particulates that come out of that bus engine or that track hoe or that front-end loader. You see that black smoke. The particulates forming that black smoke are very, very small. It's a 2.5 micrometer range and smaller, and those lodge deeply into the lungs, and that's where we get increased incidence of asthma that can be related directly to the amount of particulate that are being discharged in the area, maybe from your cleanup site. So how do we deal with that? Well, there are a number of ways to reduce the emissions, air toxics emissions, from your site. And I think the easiest one to mention that may be pretty obvious is switch from truck to rail transport. In doing so, there's about an order of magnitude efficiency increase for greenhouse gas emissions. You know, CSX is a rail company that's been advertising they can move a ton of freight 400 miles on 1 gallon of diesel. Comparatively, to move a ton of freight via a truck, it's going to be about 40 miles for that gallon of diesel to move a ton of freight. So an order of magnitude more efficient, which obviously reduces the greenhouse gas emissions by an order of magnitude, along with the air toxics. On-site disposal options, I think Carlos mentioned we don't want PRPs to be saying, well, look, monitored natural attenuation, monitored natural recovery are greener options. Let's do those. You know, we still need to go through a 9-criteria analysis. And you know, if on-site disposal is selected as part of that, that can be a way that emissions on-site can be reduced. But that's certainly not something that we want to start off by deciding what our remedies are based on whether that is, quote, green or not, which I think you know, Carlos made a good point on that. One of the things that hopefully we'll be looking into more in the not-too-distant future is how to integrate, though, the diesel emissions, particularly of air toxics, into short-term impact analyses to allow for the use or the you know, potentially the requirement of the use of lower emissions engines, emissions controls, lower emissions fuels. So what are those different emissions controls? I'll talk about that a little bit. So slide 26, emissions controls. If you have a site with no available rail access and you have a large dig and haul project, I'm going to dig a little bit into what those emissions controls look like and talk generally about the costs of those controls as well as alternative fuels. Slide 27. So the DOC, diesel oxidation catalyst, is a tailpipe addition or replacement that can be put on in line with that exhaust pipe. Might lower the clearance of your vehicle somewhat, but a very low maintenance item in the couple $1,000 range for installation that reduces particulate matter, hydrocarbons, and carbon monoxide substantially. I think the low maintenance is an attractive option there. Depending on the type of equipment, you know, the addition of these sort of emissions controls, as I mentioned, can reduce clearance, but for most off-road equipment, the so-called tailpipe is mounted behind and above the cab in a location where these kind of larger exhaust systems are not not problematic. Moving on to slide 28. Another alternative is the diesel particulate filter, which is an addition, again, on the tailpipe of a diesel engine that can reduce particulate matter, carbon monoxide, uncombusted hydrocarbons substantially and much better than the DOC, the diesel oxidation catalyst. And it's a little bit more expensive. Maybe it's in the $2,000 to $3,000 range, and that depends greatly upon the number of vehicles in your fleet. But one of the downsides for the DPF, the diesel particulate filter, is maintenance. It does require routine maintenance. It can plug, which is why it's not necessarily recommended for emergency response work. Your engine may not start if the DPF were to plug. Moving on to slide 29. Here's a rather dramatic example of the kind of emissions coming out of a typical diesel engine without emissions controls, and those with a diesel particulate filter. It really is night and day, and you don't need the filter test. You can just see that any kind of diesel engine with these emissions controls on board won't have that plume of black smoke that's so typical of particularly older diesel engines. Moving on to slide 30. For the price, around $3,000 or so, the diesel multi-stage filter, DMF, is really emissions controls. It produces reductions across the board, similar to the diesel particulate filter, but as you can see here in the slides, a very low maintenance item. And this is something we've been demonstrating with some Region 10 emergency response vehicles due to its low maintenance. And I'll come back to that a little bit more later. So slide 31. Other emissions control technologies, there's catalytic options that can be looked at that reduce air toxics across the board as well. Biodiesel is another option that without any emissions controls can reduce particulate matter as well as sulfur oxides substantially. It's been getting a lot of bad press recently related to displacement of food crop production. But in terms of the imported petroleum concern, biodiesel has a lot of advantages for that. It also has a life cycle analysis that is substantially better than a lot of the criticism you'll see in the press confuses biofuels between ethanol and biodiesel. A lot of the coverage is questioning both rather than one or the other, but ethanol has a substantially more questionable, I would say, life cycle cost. A lot of research has pegged ethanol as taking more energy to produce than you get back, which is not the case with biodiesel. So that's an option, and there are blend options that if a biodiesel is more attractive for emissions reduction at your particular site, but temperature is an issue, for example, blends could be a viable option for your particular site to say get down to the operating temperature range that you have in Alaska or in another northern state. You can basically dial in your operating temperature needs into the biodiesel blend. And for those of you that don't know, the 100% biodiesel fuel does freeze up around the freezing temperature of water. So for a cold weather site, that's something to look out for as a potential downside. And then lastly, on the alternative fuel list here, I wanted to mention ultra-low sulfur diesel, which is currently required for on-road vehicles. Trucks that leave your site and go on the pavement must be using ultra-low sulfur diesel. Sulfur has been a fuel contaminant for years and years in diesel, and that has only been recently cracked down on in order to allow for the production of diesel vehicles with emissions controls. And all of those emissions controls I mentioned would be clogged or defeated by the high sulfur fuel. Ultra-low sulfur diesel is pennies on the gallon more expensive than off-road fuel, but can instantly reduce your sulfur oxide production at the tailpipe, and it's available absolutely anywhere. that there are paved roads because it's required by law to be available. And it's being phased in for off-road equipment as well, so that's going to become a requirement. Moving on to slide 32. So here's some examples of a number of different vehicles that you can look at powering with ultra-low sulfur diesel. It would be the cheapest, the easiest thing to switch any of these vehicles over on with certain compatibility checks. You know, the biodiesel option, you know, might be attractive to further reduce overall air toxics emissions. There are also other bioproducts that may be, for the dredging example, bioproducts that can be used in the hydraulic lines for overwater work that can, you know, it's not so much an air toxics issue, but more of a greener approach to overwater work to avoid damaging fuel spills or toxic fuel spills. Moving on to slide 33. Now, just briefly, Jix, we've been working on in Region 10. I already touched on the emergency response reductions. We've been fueling those vehicles where stations are available with 100% biodiesel. When they're out on doing response work, obviously they don't have access to the biodiesel as readily, and that produces a blend in the tank, which gives them a fairly robust operating temperature range. We've also been adding diesel multi-stage filters to those emergency response vehicles to further reduce the overall emissions from those trucks. One of the downsides, as I mentioned earlier, of that is that vehicle clearance has to be checked when you're installing those devices, and they do have a nominal cost. But that has been shown to pay back in avoided health impacts. We've got at least one example of contracts that have been tailored to lower tailpipe emissions with language that both Region 9 and Region 10 have used in our ERS contracts now. And that hopefully will spread to our site-specific contracts as well. One thing I noted at the NARPM conference that I'll note here as well is that a lot of the contracting officer and project officer outreach is in the early stages of occurring right now. And so for project managers, that is something for your site-specific contract for your, you know, of course, your PRP as well. It's something that you need to bring up and ask about, and there are a number of tools out there. Mike will be talking about the surge, you know, with off-the-shelf language for contracts that can be cut and pasted, and contracting officers love to cut and paste and not generate new contract language, so that's that can be made very easy. As far as fund lead site work, Taylor Lumber is one of those sites where we did a cut and paste of that contract language that Region 9 has shared with Region 10, and we were able to get that contractor to use 20% biodiesel blended with ultra-low sulfur diesel for their off-road and on-road equipment to lower emissions there. We've been working on other fuel conversions in our vehicles, but we've been finding that warranty requirements on a lot of our newer vehicles is precluding us from making that switch before our warranties run out. A lot of companies are state very clearly in the warranty that if you use anything more than 5% biodiesel, it will void your warranty. So it's something to be careful of before making the switch, or something to time along with your warranty expiration. The Port of Portland Terminal 4 project was able to use ultra-low sulfur diesel for all of their off-road and over-water dredging equipment, which substantially lowered the sulfur oxide production there. We've had a couple sites where we've been able to switch from truck to rail transport. Moving on to slide 34, we've repowered our small flagship vessel we use for diving and sediment sampling with a lower emissions engine, which is noticeably, the fumes are noticeably less objectionable on the back of the boat. Slide 35, you can see primarily that's because of particulate matter reduction coming out of the engine. You know, today's engines are spec'd out to lower a lot of those air toxics issues, and so that's that may be a practical option depending on engine age for a vehicle at your site. Moving on to slide 36, this is example language that was taken from Region 9 or offered by Region 9 that's been used in a number of contracts, and it's certainly something that we're working on, and a lot of the tools, the contracting toolkits are now out there to give even more options in terms of language, to offer the contractor a menu of options, if you will, that they can choose from depending on their site-specific costs and concerns that can be presented to the project manager and some sort of remediation. So, seeking partners is one thing that we've been working on for quite some time, Region 9 more so than Region 10, and voluntary efforts. The surge is now out, and Michael's going to talk about Region 9's efforts on that, but a lot of these voluntary efforts have been used to build documents like that and focus on where the money can be spent on technologies that are not problematic and give reduce our air toxic emissions substantially. Mechanisms is something that there's a divergence of opinion on right now, I would say, nationally. One thing that Region 10 has been a proponent of is that voluntary efforts can only go so far. And one thing that we're trying to explore is we can require greener cleanups through our grants and cooperative agreements, but how do we do that in a stepwise fashion, in a smart way that's going to raise the overall level of education of our cooperative agreement and grant community in step with the technologies that are available. But more importantly for our PRPs, that's something that we haven't had a lot of luck with, especially for our potentially responsible parties that have no community presence or community image to upkeep. There simply is no upside for them, and when EPA offers them positive press releases, etc. And so we have shifted in Region 10 to PRP lead projects primarily or predominantly in the Superfund arena. And so one of the focus areas for our region on the national stage is ways in which we can compel reduction of air toxics in particular, but greener cleanups in general. And that may not be something that nationally EPA is ready for, but as far as the voluntary efforts go, they are somewhat self-limiting, especially given our PRP communities. And with that, I will open it up for questions.
Sean, I have a question. Should I just go ahead?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. My name is Larry Granite, EPA Region 2, and I just wanted to draw on your knowledge of transportation. I have a project where tanker trucks, using tanker trucks is a key component of the project, and
sure.
The tanker trucks, of course, have diesel engines, and they do use ultra low sulfur diesel fuel. Does using ultra low sulfur diesel fuel, is that 100%? In other words, are we all set in terms of being green? In other words, if you're using ultra low sulfur diesel fuel, do you still possibly need a diesel particulate filter or a diesel oxidation catalyst?
I would say definitely. I mean, the ultra-low sulfur diesel for an on-road vehicle like a tanker truck is the minimum that's legally required right now. You know, it's an extra thing that you can do if you're operating off-road equipment, but for on-road equipment, that is the minimum legally required. So to do something greener for your cleanup, I would suggest some sort of emissions control retrofit would be ideal. That would be the most expensive option. Something like a DMF, a diesel multi-stage filter, low maintenance. But with a $2,000 to $3,000 cost per vehicle, if that's not palatable, then perhaps moving down to a biofuel blend, a biodiesel blend, might be a lower cost way to reduce emissions somewhat beyond the minimum legal requirement.
Sean, so on this project, EPA, we have the Army Corps of Engineers that we hired to help us out, and the Army Corps hired a prime contractor, and the prime contractor hired a sub who provides the tanker trucks. So neither EPA nor the Army Corps have direct authority over the hauler, over the transporter. So is there a list of green transporters or green haulers? Is there a list?
Not that I know of. Primarily the way we have to deal with those things, requires backing up to the contract solicitation documents and the contract language and pass down requirements, essentially like that example Taylor and Erz language that came from Region 9. That's passed down essentially to all the subcontractors. Once the contract has been let, you can try to talk the subs into it via the prime, but without an offer of extra money, that can be an uphill battle.
Right. So the fact that we're using ultra low sulfur diesel fuel does not make us as green as we can be. That's what you're saying? Because we're not using the particulate filters or the oxidation catalyst.
Exactly. Using ultra-low sulfur diesel for an on-road vehicle right now is essentially what everyone is required to do. To be doing something more than a minimum legally required is what Region 9 and Region 10 have been asking of a lot of parties to do voluntarily, and mm-hmm. that's the general context of making our cleanups greener, I think, is to go at least a small step beyond the minimum legally required.
Okay. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Kathy Baylor out in EPA Region 9. Thanks for the great information, Sean, on retrofitting existing equipment. We had a question about the equipment manufacturers, if they're coming out with equipment that already incorporate the filters and the various low emission technologies. Are you familiar with any of that?
I think your question relates to what's coming off the production line right now. Is that correct?
Basically, that's it.
Yeah, all the vehicles coming off the production lines now include emissions controls like the retrofits I've been describing, and right off the shelf. And that's why the ultra-low sulfur diesel switch happened, over a year ago now. It was in preparation for that new product line of heavy-duty diesels, passenger diesels. They all come off the shelf with those really gold standard emissions controls.
Thanks a lot. That's just what we were looking for.
Thanks, Sean. And I have some online questions I'll read out to you, Sean.
Great.
The first one is from Angela Fisher from GE, and her question is, Do you have specific details on major off-road construction equipment for fuel consumption and or burn rate that can be used to help calculate emissions from remedial construction activities? For example, if I know that there will be one mid-sized excavator and one skid loader doing work on a site for 5-10 hour days, do you have a resource to get estimates for diesel consumption for this type of situation and typical values for specific vehicles and equipment?
The answer to that is I don't, but Wayne Elson in our air toxics program does, and you know, I'd be happy to refer that question on to Wayne or you know, onto one of the folks in Region 9 that I know do these calculations in order to help parties voluntarily take those steps. They do have those tools and they are available. I put Wayne's phone number on the end of the presentation along with mine, but I don't have a particular product name I can give you right now.
Okay.
Sean, this is Carlos. There's, on the green remediation webpage under technical information, there are several tools that have been developed by other program offices, as Sean suggested, and we have links to those under technical information and then the subtab of design, construction, and operations. We link to those. I also wanted to mention regarding contract language under the green remediation toolkit tab on the green remediation page. We had worked with Sean and some folks from different regions to collect language that we know had been used in remedial action contracts and pull that together and structure that, made that available to remedial project managers. We've put a copy online as well on the Green Remediation webpage, so all the language that up to a couple of months ago that we knew had been used on EPA contracts is available. Again, that's on the toolbox part of the Green Mediation webpage. Thanks,
Carlos.
And another question from online. How do you see green remediation being incorporated in the RIFS program?
Well, in terms of the RIFS phase, you know, that goes to, I think, some of the divergence of opinion right now with EPA nationally you know, whether this is something that happens voluntarily post rod only, and we're basically looking at making things greener on a voluntary basis versus looking at something, for example, that might evaluate the short and long term impacts under the short and long term impact criteria under the 9 criteria analysis as part of the RIFS, looking at evaluation of how air toxics can be reduced, and there's no final answer on that as of yet. And I think you know, again, Carlos made the right point, which is, you know, we're not looking at making things greener by not doing cleanups. You know, doing cleanups is a green thing. What we're doing is green. We're just looking at once you've selected a cleanup option, how do you reduce those short-term and long-term impacts that the cleanup can create?
Thanks, Sean. Another question from online, and this is from Russell Sirabian from Bethel, and the question is, you mentioned that filtration has been shown to obtain a payback in reduced healthcare costs. Has this been evaluated quantitatively? Has a correlation been made between vehicle emissions and impact on healthcare costs?
You know, I don't have the figures in front of me that, you know, have come from both Region 9 and Region 10. You know, fact sheets, essentially, working with the West Coast Collaborative, but essentially, yes, those you know, particulate rates come from, or the negative impacts, negative health outcomes from particulates come from health studies, and those are generalized health studies that are, that, you know, are then drilled down to You know, how much particulate does one engine contribute, and how much does spending a few dollars on reducing emissions from a particular piece of equipment relate to, you know, overall health impacts? And so those are, you know, those are from existing studies on those, on the health impacts from particulates. But I couldn't rattle off the names of the studies right now.
Is there any one more question we'll take? Is there anybody from the phone who'd like to ask a question?
Yes, we have one here.
Hi, Sean. This is Janice Austin. I'm a contractor with Black & Veatch, and we have a contract, and we do a lot of subcontractor work, obviously, for the EPA Region 4 here in Atlanta. And my question is are there any incentives that you all have implemented and maybe encouraging your subcontractors or helping them to implement some of these emission controls on their vehicles or equipment, being that we work with a lot of minority-owned, disadvantaged subcontractors? Are there any incentives available for them that maybe you all have offered them to help encourage them to do this?
As far as incentives, I would say we haven't done much, or we haven't done enough with that. But as far as having informational meetings and assisting primes and their subs, we have done that, and that that's one of the primary reasons we were able to get alternative fuels used on the Taylor site, was because we had a meeting with the subcontractor and helped them discover local vendors that offered alternative fuels, and, you know, we gave all that information to them, and all they really had to do was make a few phone calls, and it was all set up. So, yeah, we have been doing a lot of assistance with you know, both contractors, project managers, et cetera, to help offer them solutions to, you know, what is greener. You know, brainstorm ideas for folks that aren't as familiar with the emerging technologies and alternative fuels.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. There's one last question, online question, and then we move on to a third speaker. The online question is from Joan Kenton from EHS International. If reductions are required, why wouldn't the first and second tier subs not confirm? Aren't flow down provisions mandatory?
Flow down provisions, you know, are mandatory. The contract provisions do flow down. So really the key is developing, you know, good contract language for the prime, and you know, I think the earlier question related to, you know, what do you do if you don't have that language originally in your contract, and basically all you can do is talk with your contractor and see if they're willing to do something voluntarily, see if you know, the client, the owner, is willing to pay for a change order at that point. But if you get contract language in there, you know, the dialogue is going to happen with that contractor, in my experience, in terms of, well, we've read this, but, you know, EPA or owner, what did you mean, and what would qualify as meeting this requirement, those requirements do flow down.
Thanks, Sean, and we'll move on to our third speaker. Our third speaker is Michael Gill. He received his BS degree in electrical engineering from Northeastern University in Boston, and his MSEE from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York. Mr. Gill practiced electrical engineering in the 1980s with the U.S. Navy and government contractors until he made a career change to the environmental field in 1992. Gill is currently the Office of Research and Development, Superfund, and Technology Liaison to EPA's San Francisco office, which is Region 9. This position is one of technical support and information brokering. Customers are, for the most part, RPMs in the Superfund program,
but may include RCRA and other regional EPA staff, state environmental staff, industry, and the public. In this position since 1998, Tagil provides hazardous waste technical support to his customers, and he also participates in research planning, environmental technology demonstrations, and workshop planning. Tagil has been with EPA since 1992, when he took a position as a remedial project manager in Region 9 Superfund program. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you, Raji, and thank you, Sean and Carlos also. My talk today is on the Smart Energy Resources Guide, and this is a new publication that Region 9 put out 6 months ago or so. And like all the talks, this one is from the NARPM conference, which happened this past July in Portland, Oregon. Slides are pretty much the same, although some things have changed a bit over time. Go to slide 41, and here's the outline for today. I want to talk a little bit about the history of energy activities in Region 9, and then talk about the document itself, and then provide a couple of next steps. We focused our green remediation activities on energy, and this is one of Carlos's six core elements that we saw in his slide early on in his presentation. Go to slide 42. And here's the history of what we've done in the region here in San Francisco office. We started off with sort of the first step for us was writing an engineering forum issue paper. We took part in the preparation of this back in May 2004. The paper was titled Introduction to Energy Conservation and Production of Waste Cleanup Sites. It was a fairly short paper just outlining the issues, and folks realize now a lot of this is really simply optimization or best management practices. Whether you call it green or not, it's just kind of a better way to do things. And in 2005, we started working on a version 1 energy calculator, and this is really an online BTU calculator that was mentioned earlier. And for remedial technologies, it's never been released, unfortunately, but we are picking it up again and trying to improve on it and get it active. Region 9 also created a Cleanup Clean Air initiative, sort of a team of folks that were combined from the Air Division and the Superfund Division back in 2005, working on some of the same issues that Sean's been working on, diesel emission reduction, et cetera. And then in 2006, we were awarded a project, some money from our ORD office under the RARE project. This stands for Regionally Applied Research Effort. And we were able to hire an intern and start the work on this document, this Smart Energy Resources Guide. In 2007, the region hired an energy advisor, so regionally we were kind of getting our act together and putting all the efforts together, covering all different programs. And then finally, just this past May, the document came out. The RARE product, which is the Smart Energy Resources Guide, was produced. And we affectionately call it the surge. Go on to slide 43. And part of the efforts in Region 9 were to conduct this inventory of electricity and diesel emissions. There was a survey put out, and data was collected from about half of the Region 9 Superfund sites. And we were able to compile data over a 25-year period for the diesel emissions that happened within the Superfund program, and then also 20 years for the CO2 emissions. And going back to the diesel, we estimated that there were over 3,000 tons of NOx, over 800 tons of carbon monoxide, and over 100 tons of particulate matter that came from just these Superfund activities. The equivalents, we talk in equivalents, and that is about the equivalent of 54,000 buses being driven across the U.S. So it's not an insignificant activity. For the electricity consumption, this was a 20-year period. We estimated that the total CO2 emissions were over 400,000 tons. And again, in equivalence, this comes out to about 84,000 cars that are on the road for a year, or the demand from about 50,000 single-family homes. So here we are professing to clean up the environment, but obviously leaving quite a bit of a footprint at the same time. So we realized there's really got to be a better way to do things. And that's where we started getting into the green remediation activities. Go to slide 44. And this shows a couple of examples, at least one is of which has been mentioned, I think, by Carlos. But this was all before the document was written, so people had been doing some of this activity early on here in the region. We had a site down in Arizona, the Apache Powder site, where there were some solar-powered pumps used. The turbine example at the OII landfill that Carlos mentioned, where the site was able to capture the methane gas, which otherwise would have been flared off, and then use that to feed it into some turbines and create electricity on the site. And then finally, a very old example at the Lawrence Livermore National Lab site here in California, where there were some solar-powered water treatment units. They were skid-mounted, moved around to sites that were away from distribution lines, and so this was sort of a case that was out of necessity because there wasn't distribution, but it was also a great case study early on. I think the site's been using that for about 10 years. Go to the next slide, slide 45, and now we can move on to the document. This is the cover of the document. Slide 46, the question that we try to cover is what the surge can do for you. And this is a passage taken from the beginning of the document. The surge provides information on practices and technologies that can reduce emissions from electricity and diesel use at cleanup sites. So pretty much what we've been talking about today, and this is sort of a guide to help you get there. The energy needs to be managed a little bit better, and that's what we're trying to do. Slide 47. So what is the goal? Again, we want to help folks to implement renewable energy at the site and also reduce diesel emissions. And that's implement renewable energy if it makes sense. It doesn't always make sense, but the benefits can be fairly obvious. A lot of Superfund sites have long-term energy demands. We're talking 10, 20, maybe longer years. And so that demand is there. And obviously some of the sites are remote, and renewable energy can help to provide the power that's needed at those sites without running power lines. It also reduces greenhouse gas emissions and air pollutants. And finally, it's really EPA's place to provide some leadership in this area. And so that's one of the reasons we're trying to do this. For the diesel emissions, Sean covered some of these harmful aspects of the emissions, the PM, and also the likely human carcinogen and respiratory irritant. So reducing emissions is obviously a positive, and sometimes you can reduce the cost too. Obviously, in the past 6 months, we've been on a little bit of a roller coaster, from $40 a barrel to what was it, $147 a barrel, and now back down again. But what's the future going to bring? We really don't know, and it doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to, even if it's maybe a little bit difference in price from what it was a couple months ago. We think it's the right thing to do. Let's go on to slide 48. I want to talk a little bit about the outline of the document. We cover a number of renewable technologies. They're listed here: solar, wind, landfill gas to energy, anaerobic digestion, biomass gasification, and cleaner diesel. And within each section for these renewables, there are basics that are covered, certain assessments, some costs are covered, and then also some success stories. And finally, and this second bullet is a little bit more Region 9 centric, but there are a number of funding resources and opportunities that are brought out. Every state has different opportunities, every utility, and so we've kind of highlighted those within this chapter for the Region 9 states. Go on to the next page, next slide, number 49. And this is a couple more sections I'm highlighting where we're talking about some tools that are out there. A lot of these are on that CLUIN.org webpage, the green remediation webpage Carlos mentioned. We cover some calculators, some references, some programs. And then in the appendices, there's a little bit more than the basics on the technologies. We cover the contracts language, some federal regulations that might apply, and then also the utility programs. And just going back to what Sean talked about, the contracts language, I just want to reiterate that as we've got an audience on the phone now that's both EPA and beyond, but for the EPA folks, as you know, we deal with both fund lead sites and PRP lead sites. The fund lead sites are where the project managers can have most effect. And so if you can get that contract language built into your contracts, that's where you can have the most effect without a regulation. We don't have any regulations here to work with, so it's voluntary for the PRPs, but for us we can have an effect through using that contract language. Let's go to the next slide, 50. Just drilling down a little bit more into a specific chapter, the solar power chapter. This is an outline of what we cover in the document, the terminology that's used around that technology, the basics of the technology, assessing solar power potential and the size of the PV system, the photovoltaic system. What do you really need to, based on your power needs? There's a little bit of a design guide there. We talk about grid-tied or standalone systems. With solar power, it's usable if you're off the grid, but it's also usable when you're on the grid, and you might be able to actually sell some power back based on the rules with the utility. So there's some guidance on that. We cover capital cost, the operation and maintenance, a little bit on the installers and the warranties that are out there from, again, some West Coast companies. And then finally, permits and environmental concerns and success stories. So that's a little bit of detail that's on that solar power chapter. Let's go to the next slide, 51. And this is drilling down to one more chapter. And this is what's in the tools chapter. It's sort of a compilation of already available tools that are out there. It doesn't really create anything new, but there are a number of energy efficiency calculators that we talk about, informational resources on how to purchase clean energy. Each area is different, each state's different, so that covers some of that. Economic calculators, does it make sense economically to do this? There are some calculators that can help you with that. And finally, various other tools, solar power, wind power tools. So that's a compilation of some already available tools that are out there. Let's go to the next page, 52. The audience at the original NARPM talk where this presentation was done were RPMs, and so I put together a couple of points here that might be able to help those folks. How can you actually use this? You can assess the possibilities for your project. Perhaps you're already into your project. You think you're going along smoothly, and then you might have five year reviews to do, but perhaps you can still take advantage of this. If, for instance, power prices go through the roof again, that might be one way to justify it. The document can provide for you to get smart when you communicate with developers or contractors. You know, you might put that language in your contract, but getting up to speed on the issues can help you to push that through as well. It can provide a starting point to implement some clean energy projects at your site. You might have a DOD facility, for instance, that it's actually a whole large array of sites when you have a DOD site, so perhaps you can help your PRP, the military, to determine which ones might benefit from renewables or some diesel emission projects. It is a good resource, a good reference for funding resources, rather, and like I said, these are all different across different states, so you might not get a lot if you're not in the West Coast from this document, but it can sort of tell you what's out there, and you can search through your own state. And finally, to justify the expenditures on going with renewables, these tools might be able to help you do that. Next steps, let's go to slide 53. A number of us in the regions are surrounded by RPMs who may or may not have used this. Try to find out who is using it, and they can provide you the pros and cons, the pitfalls, lessons learned if they've used renewables. You've got a couple of contacts from today's talk as well. And there's also a new tool out there, which I didn't put the website down there, but it can help you to review whether your site in particular, using GIS and site-specific data, is really positioned well for the use of solar or wind power. I'm not sure but what the title of the tool is, but it's sort of a Google Earth tool that overlays a number of the Superfund sites, I think all the Superfund sites in the U.S., and with Google Earth, and also some national renewable energy lab data that shows potential for wind, for solar throughout the U.S. So those things can help you get going as well. Go to the next slide, 54, and this is the web link for the document. It is available. It's a couple hundred pages, so we only printed a few copies, actually, so this is the way to get the access to it online. Slide 55, I want to just provide a couple of acknowledgments. First off, the author, Jennifer Wang, thanks to her, this document is out there. She's now with Energy Solutions in Oakland, California. She was our intern that was funded through that RARE grant. Penny McDaniel, another Region 9 person who's actually on a detail to our headquarters in D.C., she helped to initiate that Clean Up Clean Air initiative that I spoke about earlier. Steve Rock is with our ORD lab in Cincinnati. That's an EPA laboratory, and he provided the funding and also creation of the document. The Engineering Forum, thanks to the Engineering Forum for providing some early guidance on the green remediation activities that we do, and then also for putting on this seminar series, and also thanks to the numerous peer reviewers who got the document out there. Slide 56. Thanks for your attention, and there's my contact information. If you have any questions now or later, I'd be glad to help you. And slide 57, I think, says that's about it. We've got some links to additional resources, feedback there. But any questions right now, I'd be glad to try to answer them.
Thanks, Mike. Does anybody on the phone line have any questions?
Yeah, this is Dorothy Allen from Massachusetts.
Go ahead.
On your slide 43, I have a question in regards to your diesel emissions and your emissions from the electricity consumption. And what I kind of can't understand is why you don't have CO2 under diesel and you don't have the NOx, the CO, and the PM under the electricity consumption.
Well, I took this data from somebody else, so it was what was calculated from the survey that was conducted here in Region 9. I honestly don't know the answer to your question why that wasn't concerned.
Well, it would seem that if you have the concerns with some of these contaminants, that you know, both classes of the contaminants would be emissions from both sources. So, you know, I would really love to see, for instance, the CO2 emissions from the diesel that's spent on Superfund sites. And the other question I had was with regards to demand management, whether you've looked into managing demand and taking some of these high electricity power off the grid at a time of demand.
You mean during remediation time?
Well, in that you don't really have to have a lot of your pumps running, you know, in the middle of the summer during a heat wave. And if you just manage your demand that way, you can save money and avoid peaking facilities.
That's certainly a way to save energy. I mean, there are different pricing schemes, so yeah, I understand what you're saying. I think that goes along with the operation and maintenance. It's not so much. And I'm not sure if that's covered in the document, to tell you the truth, but no, we, in that early document that I had mentioned on slide 42, that is mentioned in there. It's a way to conserve and save money as well, is to do that cyclic pumping. I think that's your question, correct?
Yeah, because it saves both cost and it you actually get payments back from the utility if you do that. You know, just basically taking advantage of demand response for a lot of these facilities, and large CNI facilities do that.
Okay, thank you.
This line, and Carlos, are you still here? Are you still on?
Yes, I am. Raji, hi.
It's an online question, and this is directed at you. And the question is, are there any organizations that have shown an interest in providing certifications or accreditations for being a green remediation company or consultant?
Thanks, Raji, and thanks for the question. That's the type of groundwork that we're laying, the type of feedback that we're requesting. I've mentioned some of the venues through which we have presented this this concept and discussed it. We don't have a quantitative market analysis yet of what the business what the demand might be for this program. However, through conversations with states, industry organizations, and other fora, we certainly have received perceived an interest in this program. We've talked to a couple of what are called standards development organizations, such as the ASTM, and our initial conversations are also very positive in that sense. They do have an interest in taking this on. However, we have not yet fully developed the criteria of which SDO we'd like to work with. So with that decision, we don't expect to make it till next summer. There will be future occasions, and anything that comes out will certainly announce through the Kluwer Green Remediation URL website. So if the person asking the question has any ideas, I'd love to hear from them. Please do get in touch with me.
Thanks, Carlos. Any questions from the phone participants for Mike Gill?
Yes, Mike. Hi, this is Mikos. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. One question, you had listed clean diesel as a renewable technology, and I was just wondering about that. By that, do you mean you included biodiesel in the mix, or I'm just wondering why you categorized it like that? And it's a two-part question, actually. And the second part is directed toward the previous speaker. I believe it was Scott, Sean, which has to do with incentives or disincentives, actually, particularly around use of biodiesel. There was mention that the engine manufacturers would penalize someone for violating the warranty if too large a mix of biodiesel were used. And I'm kind of curious, under all the discussion in Congress about the auto manufacturer bailout, whether you've heard of any engine manufacturer offering up things like removing such restrictions such that biodiesel could be used, or they're modifying their engines such that they would encourage that kind of use in the future.
Really?
Well, this is Sean. I think right now the engines that are coming out are wholly compatible with 100% biodiesel, you know, subject to the temperature restrictions I mentioned. But simply for, you know, lack of education or you know, fear on the company's part, additional liability, what have you, they're putting these restrictions on, and I don't think there's much visibility to those issues as of yet. You know, most of the biofuels discussion on the national stage relates to ethanol and flexible fuel vehicles. In fact, GSA has a stipulation on all their diesel vehicles that, regardless of warranty, that a vehicle that EPA gets from GSA can go only up to 20% biodiesel, and then GSA restricts higher blends via their lease agreement with the agency. So there's a lot of education that needs to be done, but I guess the underbelly of that is that, you know, biodiesel does not have as strong of a lobby relative to the other biofuels out there. And, you know, until that changes, a lot of the legislation likely won't change, in my opinion.
And, Mikos, I'll just give you the quick answer to slide 48. You're right, that cleaner diesel does not belong in that renewable technologies section. Good catch. Next time I do this presentation, I'll make sure and fix that. Thank you.
There's one online question, and it is from William Brainerd, and he's from CRC Watersheds Association. It says, it appears that you have been discussing mostly energy alternatives. What about other components of LEED, that is water conservation, indoor air quality, stormwater management, and site assessment? How are you interfacing with the U.S. Green Building Council?
I guess any one of us could take this, but Region 9 has concentrated on the energy issues. Like I said earlier, there, if you looked at Carlos's six different core elements, we kind of concentrated on the one that's energy. There are many aspects to this green remediation beast, though, so a lot of work needs to be done. I think headquarters has taken a good lead and hitting some of those other issues. Carlos, I don't know if you want to add anything, but Region 9 has been concentrating on energy, and you know, yeah, we all need to concentrate on the whole wheel, as Carlos had described.
Thanks. Thanks for the question. Thanks, Mike. And I recognize that, and I tried to highlight the fact that even I was, for the purpose of this call, was focusing on energy aspects, because that is where a lot of the conversation is. But we're certainly not forgetting about the other core elements of green cleanups. And that's why we, on the green remediation webpage, for example, that wheel, that image, we made it live, so you can click to each, on each click will take you to an example of some of the best practices in those core elements, including as the listener mentioned, issues such as water quality and the other components of the core elements of green remediation. So the table highlights what some of those best practices are written up, and I'd also suggest that they visit the primer or download the or order a hard copy of the primer, where all best practices across the six core elements of green remediation best practices are identified, highlighted, and some examples and case studies are provided. If the listener has ideas of practices and projects that they know of that we can highlight, a lot of this, as Mike suggested, has to do with raising awareness.
This is Sean, I'd add on to what Carlos and Mike mentioned is that we've got a land revitalization work group that's talking a lot about the uses of the Superfund site as an example after cleanup, and I think there is a recognition that in terms of the property's whole life cycle, the land's whole life cycle, that the biggest energy consumer there is how the building runs and operates if there's a building built on the Superfund site after the cleanup's completed. And our brownfields programs are focusing more on that now. Region 10's brownfields folks are adding new language to grants that are coming out, and there is a recognition that we have the greener cleanup piece, but the long term site use is in fact the bigger issue, and one other recognition of that is that GSA is now requiring our lease agreements, not just for EPA, but they're requiring those lease agreements be with LEED certified buildings. So I think that's being recognized, and you're gonna see it more in particularly our brownfields program.
Sean, Jimmy Spiro from Cal EPA. I'm just wondering about the relative efficiency of the diesel multi-stage filter. You talk about the diesel particulate filter emissions, the reductions in several different pollutants, but you don't talk about the efficiency of the diesel multi-stage filter. Is there more information on that and the advantage of using that over using the particulate filter?
Sure. That's a good question, and that was basically an artifact of the graphic I used. I'll need to fix that on my next presentation. But the efficiencies are really very similar between the diesel particulate filters and the diesel multi-stage filters. To get I would have to look up the particulars, but they're very similar, and the diesel multi-stage filter does a lot better than the diesel oxidation catalyst, for example. So it's more in line with the DPF, except for the maintenance, the level of maintenance required. The DMF is virtually maintenance free versus the DPF is much higher maintenance. I believe those figures will be listed in that relevant component of the surge. Is that correct, Michael?
Honestly, not sure.
But we, you know, we can get that to you if that's of particular interest.
Great, great.
Sean, looks like there's one question online for you. It's from Boston, Massachusetts. Are there any large trucks or other big vehicles being fueled with CNG?
With CNG? I'm not aware of any. You know, the CNG program for GSA had been alive for quite some time, and it's being largely replaced from what I've seen with the flexible fuel vehicles. But as far as heavy duty diesel engines, the fuel of choice is basically diesel, and that's for a lot of reasons. The greenhouse gas emissions are much lower on the diesel end of things than for, you know, gasoline or other types of fuels in terms of fuel efficiency. That's been a choice, the fuel efficiency choice, for a long time. And you know, I haven't heard of that, but you know, it's not to say that it couldn't be done.
Thank you. Okay, we'll take one last question from the phone audience. Any last question? Okay, hearing no questions. Thank you, Carlos. Thank you, Sean. And thank you, Mike. And just a reminder, on the front page, there's an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the feedback form. So we do look at your comments, and we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. So thank you all. We'll see you all on January 13th. Thanks.
Thank you.